This guy, like I literally felt like I was in the, it was in a situation where I could have permanent damage or die. That punch was so hard that hit me. I thought that I had a hole in my face. That's the way it felt because he broke my orbital in three places. He also broke my nose, and because of the nerve damage, my face went numb. What I didn't realize was that his ability to understand your rhythm, acknowledge it, adjust it on the fly was second to none. If I didn't do that, I wouldn't be here. And not only skill-wise, but also acknowledging, my talent. I remember sparring Canelo and being like, and then, I'm looking at him in Ring Magazine with a Ferrari, and I'm like, I'm this good.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tris Dixon.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, well, let's pull him back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning and there's nothing else.
Hello, welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. This week I'm joined by former WBO champion Chris Algieri. Chris is also a former world kickboxing champion. He has a fantastic story and he's someone I don't think I've ever interviewed before, but I always figured and when I'd seen interviews with him that we could have a really good discussion. I was really pleased with how this worked out. In fact, it's something I'd like to do again because once I got off the phone with him, there were more questions about the questions that I had. And normally that's not the case, but I really enjoyed talking to Chris and thought we bonded. It was great stuff. There was a lot of really cool stuff in this chat. And I mean, some of the stuff I knew, some of the stuff I didn't know. And I really enjoyed him obviously talking about Khan, Pacquiao and sparring the likes of Canelo and fighting Conor Benn and the Provodnikov fight, which is obviously really colourful in its descriptions and everything else. I was fascinated by his stories of going on the road, sparring and furthering his education, as well as stuff about the trainers he'd worked with. And also there's a lump here where we talk about nutrition. And obviously there's no one better place to talk about that in boxing than Chris, who has his own book, Fighter's Kitchen, because he's a nutritionist and he's worked with fighters like Sullivan Barrera and Danny Jacobs to help them hit weight and be strong at the weight, and really enjoyed getting into the weeds a little bit about nutrition. Some good stuff in there, and it was great just to talk to Chris, great to connect with him. He is, as we mentioned at the back of this podcast, now co-hosting Inside Boxing, the podcast with Dan Canobio, my friend from CompuBox, and they're a great combination. Before I leave you with Chris, huge thanks to my sponsors, as always, at Hansen Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hansen Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansenlee.com. You do get access early on my Patreon at patreon.com/Tristics, and it's also a way of helping this podcast survive and thrive. Guys, I really hope you enjoy listening to the brilliant Chris Algieri.
Chris, it's great to see you. So how's things? How's life?
Life is great. Life is great. I've been keeping very busy. I've been training like I always am. I would like to fight again before the year's over. And so that's always keeping me busy, but also between broadcasting, podcasting, and I'm actually working as an adjunct professor at a university down here in South Florida. I've been spread pretty thin.
Yeah, which is crazy, right? Like, so what's the point of fighting on when you've got so many plates to spin, you've done what you've achieved in boxing? Like, why do you need to still fight on?
Oh, I don't need to. I love the lifestyle. I love fighting. I love training to fight. My body is starting to be a little, tore up from all the injuries over the years. But as long as I'm able to still hang with the young bucks in the gym, then it's going to be hard for me to stay out of the ring.
So is that going to be your sign when you're slipping in training that you're going to call it a day? That will be your wake up call. One day you'll be in the gym, you'll be like, okay, no, I'm done.
100%. Yeah. And that's kind of what I've been saying for years now. I remember after the pandemic having a lot of time off and then going back to the gym and being scared. I'm like, all right, this could be the last day of the career of Chris Algieri. If I go in the gym and I get beat up by these guys, then you know, then it's that's it. It's a wrap. I don't need to do this. I'm very proud and satisfied with what I've done in my boxing career. And, you know, everything else is for the past couple of years has really just been, you know, icing on the cake. But yeah, no, if this machine can't do it anymore, then, you know, that's it. That's a wrap.
What do you love the most? Is it the buzz of fight night, or is it the identity of being a ex-world champ and a fighter? What's the motivation? Why are you doing it?
You know, for me, it's the identity thing is not really a part of it for me, especially because I work in so many other worlds where that doesn't matter. No one cares if I can fight or if I'm a world champion, if I'm at the university, or, you know, if I'm out, you know, just talking to my family and my friends. I don't hang around a lot of boxing people. So that's not really it for me. I don't want to be known as, you know, just the fighter or the champion. Like I do a lot of other things. I always have. So for me, yeah, it's just the lifestyle, man, the Spartan lifestyle of training, the discipline, having something to do every day. That's hard, you know, really pushing yourself. Always, you know, there's always things to learn. Boxing is so complicated. It literally takes a lifetime to get good at it. And you never stop learning in the gym. And I just love that. I love that there's always a progression. There's always something to strive for. There's always a way to be better. So for me, that's a big drive. It's just, you know, pushing myself to be better, you know, and boxing does that, I think, at all levels.
I'm sure you've had this question a ton of times over the years, but with what you've gone on to do and with what you've gone on to achieve in boxing, you could have chosen easier paths, right? I know that you're obviously clearly passionate about the fight game and everything else, but what led you to boxing and combat sports when you could have had, let's be honest, easier options, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could have chose easier routes. My route could have been easier even in the difficult one that I chose. But, you know, everyone gets the hand that you're dealt, and you just got to deal with it. I don't think I had a particularly good hand when it came to me coming up in the sport of boxing, but I made the best of it. And in terms of why I chose to even pursue boxing at all, I was like, man, this has been a passion project my whole life. I grew up watching fights as a little kid, sitting on my grandfather's lap, watching a fight. My grandfather was my hero, and he was talking about these guys like they were his hero. So for me, I'm like, I want to be like my hero's hero. So for me, it was like, I want to live my childhood dream every day. And I get to do that as a fighter.
So who were these guys that you were watching with your granddad?
So this was in the early 90s, from what I can remember. And that was like the Mike Tyson, Roy Jones Jr., Oscar De La Hoya era. Oscar, I loved Oscar, man. He was the golden boy, especially in the mid 90s. These young boys forget, he was an absolute machine. I mean, he was destroying guys. Him at 135, at 140, and then all those big fights at 147. I mean, he was something to watch. But also, he had that personality outside of the ring too. He was the crossover star, the golden boy who could, you know, go in there, get the job done, get the knockout, be a killer in the ring, and then right after, he's smiling for cameras, and then he's off to a photo shoot for some billboard or marketing campaign somewhere. You know, the guy had it all. And then my grandfather always spoke about the greats of the past. Sugar Ray Leonard was one of his favorites. He said that he was, you know, the best he had ever seen. Alexis Arguello was someone that he really, really was passionate about. That was someone that, really caught my attention pretty early on. You know, I was literally going to like the library to get anything I could get on boxing when I was a kid, back when libraries were a thing, before the internet. And, I loved reading about fighters. I loved reading about fights. So that was just my grandfather just leading me on that path.
What about your mum and dad? What did they do for work? Anything involved in boxing at all in any way, shape, or form?
No. I'm the first Algerian to box. I thought I was going to be the last, but my oldest nephew just picked it up recently, so he's been competing in the amateurs. But no, my parents. My mother was she worked in insurance and then eventually got into the healthcare system. And my father, you know, was a blue collar laborer. Basically, he was a carpenter my whole life. And then he worked for the highway department, you know, fixing roads. So,
Yeah, sorry. So, I mean, so your first foray into combat sports is Chinese Kempo, right? Karate.
Right.
So how come you go to that rather than boxing? If boxing is this passion, what is it? Was it a local thing? Was it, oh, there's a gym there, or what was it? Or did you have other heroes, martial artists, and that kind of stuff?
honestly, there, I mean, it was Long Island. There wasn't a lot of boxing. You know, I was the second world champion ever from Long Island. And, you know, it wasn't really a boxing centric place. It's grown a lot. In the past 20 years, it's really become a hotbed. We've got guys like Jamel Herring, Joe Smith Jr., myself, you know, Buddy McGirt was the first world champion from Long Island. So we've grown a lot in the last couple of years. But yeah, back then in the 90s, there wasn't really boxing gyms on Long Island. You know, we always had Gleason's in Brooklyn, but that's a hike from where I lived. We were looking at a good hour, and then dealing with parking and all that. It wasn't feasible for me as a 9-year-old to go into Brooklyn, you know, to go, to go
sounds
train.
Terrifying.
Yeah, exactly. So martial arts was, you know, there were martial arts dojos everywhere. I watched a lot of old school kung fu movies with my dad. Jackie Chan and Bruce Lee were heroes of mine as well. So yeah, we were just looking for a sport for me. Teen sports were not for me. My brother was good at everything and I wasn't. So I was just kind of always in his shadow. I was like, I got to find my thing. And then martial arts was it, man. I fell in love right away.
Did you have other career aspirations?
No.
No, you wanted to fight.
Oh, I knew I was going to fight. I went to my first fight, I think, when I was 11 or 12 years old. And I looked at my dad and I'm like, I'm doing this. I'm going to do this. And he looked at me. He's like, we got to talk to your mother. But they weren't really too excited about my career path. But yeah, I always knew. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew what I was going to be.
Wow, that's really interesting, given obviously the options that would come your way over the years. Did you get into trouble at all as a kid, or were you good? Were you a good boy?
I was good in school. So for me, education was pushed very, very in the forefront for me growing up. From my mother's from Argentina. She's a first generation immigrant, and we lived with her father and mother. And, you know, immigrants in America, it's hardworking people. Education is really, really important, because they always saw that education is going to get you to that next level. We're coming here. We don't have a lot of money. Everyone wants to see their kids do better, right? So they were always saying that education is the way to do it. My grandfather was an engineer. So he was like, school, 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 school. Really pushed that for me. So it was really important that I did well in school. And I did. But I was from Long Island, and Long Island's can be a pretty, it's a very nice place to grow up and to live, but it's especially as you get a little bit older, certain towns, it's kind of a fight town. So a lot of fist fights, a lot of that kind of stuff. But I mean, not dangerous the way it is now. Kids now have guns and knives and stuff. But back then it was just, you know, horseplay and fist fighting, and, you know, foot races turn into fist fights. You know, it's just kind of, that's kind of how I grew up.
And then you got a bachelor's degree in healthcare, which is kind of the opposite of boxing, right?
Yeah. I had a pretty good science brain. You know, I think that, you know, spending so much time with my grandfather, who was an engineer, got me very interested in sciences and math and physical sciences and biology and things like that. And then me as an athlete, I was a wrestler in high school. I was a martial artist prior to that. And I knew I wanted to kickbox and then eventually box. So biology became really important to me, physiology, the way the human body worked, anatomy, and that kind of led me to nutrition. And like I said, I did very well in school, and a lot of my my counselors and my teachers were pushing me to go to medical school and to go the route of being a physician. I don't like hospitals. I never really have. I was very against it when they were all telling me to do that. But more and more, as I kept taking more of the courses that would keep people out of being in pre-med or going to medical school, I was doing really well. So which kind of pushed me in that direction. And I mean, part of it was literally, I was like, I want to learn about the human body. I want to learn about nutrition. I want to learn about health, because it's going to help my boxing and my fight career. But then also I'm like, oh, I've gone this far. This can actually be a career as well.
Yeah. So obviously you got your master's in nutrition, which is fascinating. I'm sure we'll get to that in a minute. Let me ask you this. Obviously, you've mentioned the wrestling. I've mentioned the Kenpo, and obviously kickboxing's coming. What was MMA ever a thing? Because you can spin all these plates, right? You can do it all.
Yeah. Everyone always asks me that, and literally it never crossed my mind. Just like I said in the beginning about boxing, it's like, you asked, like, why boxing? It's like, well, I grew up watching it as a kid. Like, I get to live my childhood dream. There was no MMA when I was a kid. You know,
so you went into like the Hoist Gracie, Ken Shamrock era, that kind of stuff.
I was, but I was a little bit older already. So, and I was already hooked on boxing. You know, it, listen, it could have been different if I had grown up 5 years later. You know, if I was born in 1990 and then grew up where, you know, watching Hoist Gracie and Ken Shamrock and then eventually Randy Couture and Chuck Liddell. And I watched those guys, and trust me, I watched them all anyway, but I was already hooked on boxing. It, there wasn't room for me to push that to the side, to be like, oh, I'm going to be an MMA star. I didn't, you know, I loved fighting. I love every aspect of fighting. But yeah, no, MMA was not the thing for me when I was growing up.
Now you've tried obviously all these things and got to different levels, generally very good levels at all of them. What were you best at? Were you best at boxing? Would you say that?
I would say yes, because it's just so much harder in terms of the talent pool and the population of people that do it and the money that's involved. So you get people who can be like truly dedicated world-class athletes in boxing. Kickboxing is a little bit different. You know, I kind of miss those years where we had guys who were like the super, super high level guys in the K1 and early, the K1 Max in the early 2000s. You know, and even then they weren't making the biggest money, but you know, they did just fine. But, yeah, I think with the talent pool of boxing, because of what can be afforded to the victors, I think those guys are just so good. So for me to be world class at that is it's pretty indicative of you know, that I was probably best at boxing. And even when I kickboxed, my hands I was always the best part of my fighting style.
So, you know, a lot of the greats have talked about pre-fight nerves before. When you talk to Mike Tyson, George Foreman, you know, like all these guys talked about pre-fight fear. Is it worse for boxing than is other combat sports?
I don't know. I didn't notice a marked difference between kickboxing and boxing. Well, except for my pro debut in boxing, because it was my first time boxing. I didn't have any amateur fights as a boxer. I went from my last kickboxing fight right to the pros in boxing. I was very nervous for that because it was just a new sport. It was something I had never done at any level. So for me, that was very nerve wracking. I vividly remember being nervous for that fight, more so probably than maybe any fight I've ever had, honestly. But I don't think it was any difference between the two fight sports in terms of kickboxing and boxing. So yeah, I don't know how to answer that one.
Okay, no, that's fine. And in terms of being a kickboxer, you obviously fought at a very high level. Were you a pro, like, or did you have to have other work at the same time?
No, I didn't make enough money where it was the only thing I could do. I worked for most of my boxing career as well until I won the title. I was working the whole time. I was putting myself through my training camps. I didn't have any kind of, like, my promotion wasn't, they weren't giving me a stipend or anything to live off of. I had to work. But yeah, kickboxing, again, at the time that I was fighting, there really wasn't a lot of money to it. We got caught, when I kickboxed, I really got caught in between the birth of MMA and boxing. So people kind of spread, they went one way or the other. It left kickboxing out in the dark, man. There wasn't a fan base for it. It wasn't on TV anymore. It fell in a pretty dark space when I was competing at the highest level in those early 2000s.
And you were a two-time world champ, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, the WK super welterweight champion and the ISK welterweight.
Where did you do that? I mean, where were those finals? Were they in the US or were they further afield?
Yeah, so I fought all over, but I got my ISK world title and in Atlantic City at the Tropicana, which was a pretty cool venue to fight at. One that I've been to see a lot of fights growing up, and that was my last kickboxing fight. Once I won that title, that was the one I always wanted. The ISK, that was like the most coveted belt for everyone who was in the, you know, in kickboxing. It's like when you meet other ISK world champions, they all give you that nod, like, yeah, you're a real world champion.
So, and that puts you in a group with Troy Dorsey and Vitaly Klitschko, right?
That's right.
Fighters who moved across after winning that title.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. People always forget that there was other ones too, and that you nailed it.
Do you know Troy?
I do not. I have never met Troy. But I mean, he was a scrappy dude, man. I love watching his old fights.
Yeah, he's still around and about, I think. So you turned pro in 2008, you know, boxing. Did you think that, oh, you know, I've won a world title now in kickboxing, I'll just go and do that in boxing?
I said that. I didn't, you know, I don't know how much I knew if that was really going to happen or not. And I don't think I was cocky about it. But I had been, you know, my friends from high school will all say it. It was before I even turned pro in kickboxing. I said, I'm going to win two world titles in kickboxing. One of them is going to be the ISK. then I'm going to go to boxing and I'm going to win a world title there. And then I also said, I'm going to make $1 million. And I said, you know, I said some other things that, but, and I said it as young as 15 years old. My good friends still to this day remember when I said that, and they're like, shit, you really made that happen. I don't know if I believed it. I don't know what it was. I guess I obviously must have believed it, but I said it a whole lot. I said it a whole lot.
Well, that's the secret, right? You talked it into existence. Yeah.
Pretty much. I told everyone who would listen that I was going to be at least a 3-time world champion. I should have said it more. I should have said I was going to be 4- or 5-time world champion, honestly.
Just to round it up. Yeah. No, that's great stuff. But like in terms of the turning pro, obviously you said you didn't have any amateur stuff. In fact, before I go to that, Chris, let me ask you. So these friends that you're telling this stuff to, are they fight people or are they regular civilians?
Oh, no, regular civilians. I didn't grow up with fight people. I didn't grow up around a lot of fighters. I never really hung out with a lot of fighters. You know, I have a very small group of friends. Like I said, I was a wrestler in high school, so a lot of my oldest friends are all guys from my wrestling team that I grew up with.
Because what I'm getting at here, and I was having this conversation with someone earlier today in the gym, and we were talking about physiques. And obviously, you've got a shredded physique, right? Which obviously, I'm sure we'll come into with the nutrition side of things. But it doesn't mean you can fight, right? No. Obviously, people, these friends I'm talking about probably look at you and think, he's going to kick everyone's ass. Because some people have that basic level thing. We still see it now, right? When we see fighters on the scales, it's like, oh, yeah, fighter A looks like Hercules. And fighter B looks like a tub of goo. A is going to win every time. It's not the case, right? So maybe that's part of the expectation. I was wondering, this is what we were talking about. You know, physiques and the lead to expectation means that instantly you're brilliant at something. And it doesn't necessarily mean that, right?
No, not at all. But all my friends, though, were all pretty, pretty fit guys. We were all athletes, you know, whether they were soccer players or wrestlers. You know, one of my best friends is a Gracie Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. You know, he's still in superb shape. My brother, who is my best friend, is in fantastic shape. You know, so I've always was surrounded by guys who looked the part, at least. But honestly, we all of us could fight too.
Yeah.
One way or another.
I suppose I'm talking about that expectation really, where, you know, you go out to a ring looking a certain type of way and everyone thinks, oh, he's going to win because he's the guy with the six pack. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think I learned, like, that's one thing about wrestling. Wrestling is such a great sport and it's so humbling because you can be in awesome shape and you can be the man one weekend and then you're getting your butt kicked the next. Wrestling, I mean, there's so many different levels to wrestling. Wrestling, you wrestle so often, everybody loses. You know, very rarely do you see undefeated guys at high levels for a long period of time. Everybody loses. You wrestle, you know, you wrestle a couple 100 matches in a season, so you're gonna catch losses here and there. And yeah, I mean, I was 16 years old and I was in awesome shape. I was ripped and I was strong and I was ready to go, but I still got my butt kicked in wrestling matches at times. So I think you get humbled pretty quick from that sport.
And also, I mean, even in boxing, when you look at someone like Tyson Fury, he's a 12-round fighter, right? It doesn't matter if he's got a six-pack or not. He's a 12-round fighter. Like, it's, you know, and people might say the opposite about Anthony Joshua. Maybe there's question marks about his engine. So it's weird, isn't it? You know, when you talk about these physiques and, you know, I don't know. It's something that, you know, and especially the boxing press, where there's not a lot of education, I think, in nutrition and training and that, where they literally think they see someone on the scales and say, yeah, he's in great shape. Well, you know, that doesn't necessarily tell the whole story.
Well, so, if you look at a bodybuilder, you know, they're pretty much in the worst physical shape you could ever be in, but they look fantastic. You know, everybody wants to look like that guy on stage, but ask that guy how he feels when he steps off that stage. I guarantee you, he's going to tell you he doesn't feel that good.
Well, I remember seeing a Mr. Olympia video when I was a kid, like an old VHS one. And it was the press conference like the day before. And these guys were all dropping like flies at the press conference. And like they're passing out and they're falling over and they're having to be led from the table and stuff. Like they're literally on the edge. But they look magnificent, but it means nothing, right?
That's right. I mean, it means nothing. It means nothing. Look at, you know, a guy like Andy Ruiz. Everybody looks at him. It's like, what that physique. And meanwhile, he's got a great engine. He's strong. He's fast. He's durable. The guy's literally got it all. But he doesn't look the part.
Sure. In terms of the turning pro, was that a humbling period where you're on small bills for, I'm assuming, short money, right?
Oh, yeah. I think my first fight, I made $400 from my first fight for a 4-rounder, $100 a round. I mean, it was humbling in a way because I had come from such a high level in kickboxing. And I had made some money in my world title fights, nothing really to speak of, but it was something. And to go back down to 404 rounders, you know, when I had fought 10, 12 rounds already, I had fought 12 rounds as a kickboxer, and now I got to fight four rounds again. That was one of the major reasons I didn't want to fight amateur at all in boxing. I was like, I don't want to do 2-3 minute rounds with a headgear on. I've been fighting pro. I got 20 pro fights. I don't want to go that far backward. It's bad enough I got to fight four rounders again. Four rounders for me are really hard. I'm a technical guy. So for me, I had to like, I only wanted a couple four rounders, and I wanted to go right up to more rounds because I'd been 12 already as a kickboxer. So for me, that was a hard transition. And it wasn't so much the money that was humbling, but I think it was the fact that I'm going to be on the beginning of a card. You know, I still had my fans who were there, but yeah, it was like, all right, I'm going to walk first. I'm going to be out there. I'm going to be one of the first. I'm used to being the main event. That was the humbling part for me.
It's worth mentioning you were 20-0 as a kickboxer, right? So, It was a big successful career. And then I was going to say that had the kickboxing made you a local celebrity, so people were turning out to see you, I guess, to a degree, right?
Yeah. I was a very good ticket seller as an amateur, as a pro boxer. And that actually helped me a lot. My career was very grassroots, very different than, you know, some of these guys you see who get signed out of the Olympics and they have a big promotional company that signs them, picks them up and pushes them along the way, and they get to fight all over. I had to fight in my hometown for the most part because I had to sell tickets. You know, there were fights where I was selling $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 worth of tickets, you know, and I was getting paid five because, you know, it was early in my career. It wasn't a lot of money to get paid, but I was bringing in a ton of money to the show because that was the main event and I was the draw. So it helped me get fights. There was never a problem for me trying to get fights because I could always sell in local areas.
Who were you sparring in those early pro days? Did you get any seasoned sparring, or were you having to make do locally?
So when I was kickboxing, I sparred a lot of boxers, a lot. Okay. Because I was, you know, I was a world-class kickboxer. There was no world-class kickboxing in the area that I was. So I had to travel quite a bit to get boxing sparring, and I would just wear sneakers and I would box. And, you know, and more and more, a lot of the coaches were like, man, for a karate guy, they called me that all the time, for a karate guy or for a kickboxer, you know, you're like, you got some hands. You got a little bit of boxer in you. I remember distinctly a coach saying that, being, man, you got some boxer in you. Then once I transitioned to boxing, then we really had to focus on getting real work. And I think one of the first world champion I ever sparred with was Vivian Harris. Okay. And we went over to New Jersey to, I believe he was in Hackensack at the time. Went over to New Jersey and sparred with him. And I was like, wow. First of all, I was like, wow, this is a different level. Holy cow. This guy's so fast and dangerous. Like, punches were whizzing by me. And I'm like, whoa, those are going to hurt. I need to really not get hit by those shots. But also as the rounds went on, I started getting my groove and getting my conditioning going. I was like, oh, wow, I'm good at this. I'm going to do something in this sport. And then Louis Collazo was a buddy of mine. I got a lot of work with him. He was fantastic. Everyone in the New York area knows Louis. Everybody's worked with him. One of the best stand-up guys in the biz. And then trying to think timeline wise, who else I was working with that time. A bunch of really tough guys of Brooklyn and Gleason's and whatnot. One of which I fought later on, Mikel Lipierre, who I fought two fights ago, was a guy I used to spar. He used to beat me up when we were sparring back in my kickboxing days. And then we end up crossing paths 10 years later, fighting at the Madison Square Garden. But then I went to Vegas. Then I sparred everybody. Canelo, then California, Brandon Rios, Marcos Maidana. I'm drawing a blank now.
I mean, this might trigger something. Has anyone kicked the living daylights out of you in sparring?
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. is there a go-to bad memory? You are like, that let's just scrub that one.
Yeah, I mean that's part of this game, and you got to try and go and get your butt kicked. You know, you really got to get good sparring, get out there and work with guys. All those guys I mentioned, I actually did really well with. But there was this one kid in Brooklyn, and he was a decent pro, the local guy, but never really went past, you know, just the local. And he was a southpaw, very long arms, and he was big and he was strong. And man, I just remember him spinning my head around. Like, just, I didn't see the punches coming. I'm just like, boom. And like, I'm looking at the back of the room. I'm like, whoa. And then going through, and then afterwards, he was like, man, he's like, you're good. That was awesome. Really hard work. I'm like, really? I'm like, I feel like I just got my ass kicked. But okay. But yeah, that was, I remember that being vividly being like, that was one of the hardest sparring sessions I ever had. And it's just, you know, just some random tough guy in Brooklyn.
But it's funny you say that. I mean, because, you know, this, you know, we talked a bit about the physical side, but the mental side of it's another thing. Some of these guys are world class in the gym, and then under the bright lights, they're not the same guy, right?
Yes, I've seen that a lot. There are guys who are absolute machines in the gym, and then fight night, they just can't pull the trigger. And I've seen the opposite too. I've seen guys who are just consistently getting whipped around the gym, and on fight night are world class. It's one of those things, man. Boxing is really complicated.
You made some steps up against Jose Alejo and Mike Arnaiotis. Those winning fights at that caliber has to tell you I made a pretty good call here, right?
Yeah. So Mike was the first real step up guy that we fought, and he had a ton of experience. He had been with everybody. And he was, dude, that guy was made out of iron. You know, I'm not sure what he was. I'm just blaming him being Greek. but he was just a physically just sturdy, rough guy. But I handled him pretty easily. That was a good step up fight. And then the Jose Peralta fight, that was that classic prospect versus prospect fight that we all have. It's a crossroads fight, right? It's like, you got this kid, he's promoted by so-and-so, we've got great hopes for him. And then we've got, you know, this other guy has this kid, and we've got great hopes for him. And we're going to meet, and one guy's going to go, and one guy's got to start over. And that was that fight for me and for him, obviously, because we weren't really any different in terms of I had a few more fights, but he had top rank behind him. He had main events behind him. He had big promotional companies that were behind him. He had a story, sleeping in his car, training, had a kid on the way, like all this, like there was a lot of fanfare about him, and he was getting a lot of media attention, because he had beaten one of our local studs. We had a kid who was a multiple time New York State Golden Gloves champ, was 5-0 with 5 knockouts, was starching everybody, and Peralta tuned him up, so he went up from there. And then we crossed paths, and it was one of those fights where every time him and I were in the same room, we were this far apart. And we were arguing, and we were pushing each other. And I mean, it was like the press conference, the weigh-in, the day of like every time that we were in the same place, we were getting at it. And it was just one of those kind of fights. And if you watch, it's one of my favorite fights of my career to watch. I think I threw 1,100 punches in a 10 rounder. I set some records for that. And he fought just like Miguel Cotto, Puerto Rican guy, hands high, great left hook, strong. And I just, volume. We treated the fight like we did every other time we were together. We just met in the middle, and we were just fighting, and it was a that kind of fight all the way through for all 10 rounds.
Which is funny, because people assume that, you know, when they look back at your career now with where you're at, they see you as, you know, a guy who's quick, technical, and all the rest of it, but you actually had it out with him.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I think that's something that that's from all the gym wars that I've had, you know, over the years, and being a guy who, you know, I'm from Long Island. So even for me going to New York City, I'm an outsider.
Yeah.
So I was always the outsider. So I came to Long Island from Long Island. I went to New York City. I'm sparring. I'm the guy in the gym that doesn't belong there. So we got to give him the hardest work. We got to send him back and knowing what we do in this gym. Same thing in New Jersey. When I went to New Jersey, same thing. I moved to Vegas for a while. All the gyms in Vegas. Who am I? I'm some white kid from Long Island. We don't have those around here. We got to tell them what we do here. California, when I was in Oxnard with Robert Garcia's gym, same thing. Then down in Miami, same thing. You know, so I was always kind of like a gym road warrior. And I like that. I like that feeling. I always felt like I had to fight. So everybody wanted to hurt me. I had to show everybody that I was tough. I couldn't back down from anybody in any of those situations. And it helped mold me for, you know, the kind of fighter that I had to be in order to win these big fights.
That's proper old school character building, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, put me in the fire, bro. That's got to harden the steel, man. I gotta be folded over and hammered out right to be right.
Well, it's funny you should say that. Obviously, I mean, I was going to mention the Emmanuel Taylor fight that got you in the rankings. He was the IBF's number 4, but then seeing as we're talking about hammering out the kinks, you fought Provodnikov. He was about as hot as he would get as well. He was about as hot as he was ever going to be. He'd had that war with Tim Bradley, I think, two fights earlier, and then he'd beaten maybe Mike Alvarado off the top of my head. And that was it. And then it's like, well, let's bring in this guy from New York and let's let him loose against this good-looking New Yorker. And, I mean, people anticipated... It seemed like it was a showcase for him almost to come to New York and all the rest of it. What kind of fight did you anticipate? Did you anticipate a rough fight for a start? Because everyone knew he came to have a scrap.
Yeah. So that whole, 100%. That was definitely, I was there as a sacrificial lamb for him. He was the boogeyman in the divisions at that point. Cause he went up to 47 to fight Tim, fight of the year, almost knocks Tim out, almost became welterweight world champion. Then loses that fight, immediately comes down, like you said, fights Mile High Mike Alvarado. Alvarado was world champion at 140, and they fought in his hometown in Denver. Provodnikov destroys him. I mean, vicious, vicious beating. Another great fight. And then it's me. They're like, oh, we'll give him an easy fight. This kid's not a puncher. He's going to box him. Like you said, he's a good-looking local guy. He's very popular. He'll sell tickets. We'll do it in New York. We'll expose Provodnikov to other fans on the East Coast because he's a California guy with Freddie Roach. He was a Manny Pacquiao sparring partner. He was a, Freddie Roach guy. So they're trying to expose him to the East Coast. And like you said, the Manuel Taylor fight is what earned me that shot, which was no easy fight at all. That kid was super tough. But I knew the fight could be a really tough fight because I've been watching Provodnikov for years on ESPN. And I remember vividly saying when I was a kid, when I was earlier in my career, watching him and being like, oof, I don't ever want to fight a guy like that. Because he was just a two-fisted killer, man. He looked it. He was rough. He was strong. He had much quicker hands than people ever remember. He actually had very quick hands on the inside. He hit super hard, and his chin was made out of absolute iron. The guy had never been really wobbled, never been down, never been stopped. But I also knew that he had a lot of issues that I could capitalize on. He was heavy footed. He didn't throw a ton of punches if you weren't right in front of him. His holes in his defense were glaring, and he was short. So I have everything I need to make this an easy fight. And I got the gas tank. I got the engine. I can go for 12. I can box circles around this guy. And that was our plan. And that was what we had hoped would happen.
Yeah. So
it didn't.
Yeah. So obviously you were down a couple of times, and you're right, I was slammed shut early. A couple of things with that. How hard is it to overcome that mindset of clawing back a deficit on the scorecards after a couple of knockdowns, particularly when you know even though you're at home, you're technically the B side because they're bringing in to showcase this guy. So you're probably not going to think you're going to get any favors done on the scorecards.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think initially in the first couple of rounds, I was really first I was mad at myself. I was very, very mad that I got hit with that shot. We had trained to hit and don't be hit, which is, what boxing is all about. And then, I had a damaged eye now I got to deal with that. And like I always say, man, in boxing, it's one of the reasons I love the sport. It's one of the reasons why it's so difficult. You make a mistake, you pay for it pretty much immediately. And for me, I paid for it immediately and for the whole rest of that night because my eye was compromised from the first 90 seconds till the final bell. And that was a tough situation to be in. Initially, I was just thinking about I need to not even claw back for the score. I need to claw back so I don't get killed. I literally felt like I was in a situation where I could have permanent damage or die. That punch was so hard that hit me. I thought that I had a hole in my face. That's the way it felt because he broke my orbital in three places. He also broke my nose. And because of the nerve damage, my face went numb. So I couldn't feel pretty much everything like this. But it literally felt like I couldn't feel anything. So it was like, is there like wind flying? Like, what's going on? Like, where is my skull smashed in? I thought my entire skull was punched in. So I literally was in a moment of survival. Like, I need to fight this man so I don't get killed tonight. And then as my style started to pick up and the game plan started to work and the strategy, I think it was like round five or six where I'm like, oh yeah, I'm back in control the way I was supposed to be. I can still win this fight. And that's when I started thinking like, okay, I got ground to make up. But that 10-7 round is going to be lingering. So if I really want to win this fight, I really got to make sure I'm putting these all in the bank.
Could you see out of that eye, or could you see his left hook coming?
In those first few rounds afterwards, yeah. But the swelling became so much that it was like, you know, that the curtain was closing every round. You know, we worked on it in between every round to try and keep it open. But so what happens when you fracture your orbital, it creates space. It creates space where there's not supposed to be space, right? So your orbital basically sits against your nasal cavity. So you got air from your nose going into your orbital area, and that orbital space, that's why your eye swells up so fast. That's not blood right away. It was air first. Cause my eye was swelling before I even got up off the ground. And that was the air pushing the skin out. And then it filled with blood as the rounds went on. So in the corner, every round, we were just doing everything we could to get the blood away from my eye so I could see for at least the first minute of the round. But by the end of every round, I was pretty much going blind. And as the rounds went, I had less and less of the round where I could see out of the eye. And then I think it was 12. It was pretty much till round 11, 12, where I was going out of the corner completely blind in that eye.
That's pretty disgusting.
Yeah. Yeah. It hurt a lot too.
Was that the most pain that you've been in the ring?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Cause the thing about swelling is, you know, swelling goes out until it can't go out anymore. And then after that, it goes that way. So what's that swelling going back. Oof.
What's your corner telling you? Oh, it's just a scratch.
Basically. My head trainer.
I can feel the air whistling through my head, and you're telling me it's a scratch.
I remember after the very first round, my late trainer Tim Lane comes in. God, rest in peace, Tim. He comes in the corner, and very first thing he says to me, he's like, he gasped me. He's like, "You good?" And I said, and I was mad. I was like, "I'm like, yeah, I'm good." And he goes, "Hey, listen, you still got your lead eye. We're good, baby. We're good. You still got your lead eye." Meaning it was my right eye. So it's my fight with my left hand in front. So I have my left eye. He's like, "You're going to see all the punches coming still. Just keep your right hand pinned. The left hook's not going to hit you, but you're going to see the right hand coming. We're good." And that was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I'm good. You know, whether it was true or not, I at that moment, I believed it. I was like, all right, I'm good. And it just, that was all the anxiety of that eye went away. Like, all right, cool. Back to fighting.
So it goes to the scorecards. Are you thinking you're going to get it?
No. I knew I won. I felt I won. I felt the energy. I felt his body language. I felt his energy. I felt my energy. I felt the crowd. I felt them swaying. I felt everything changing and in my favor. But like you said, the A side, what I was there for, I didn't think the judges would give it to me, but, as soon as I heard that first judge give it to me, the first judge gave it to him, then the second judge gave it to me, and right there, I was like, oh, I won. If one of these judges can give me the fight, I won. And because the other guy's going to do it too. If one of these, because the first one was like super wide in his favor, and I was like, here we go. And then the next one was close, and it was in my favor, and I was like, oh, that's it. That's it. Before they said the third score, I already knew I won.
So how beaten up are you after a fight like that in terms of the recovery? You know, the because obviously there's a lot of stuff that people aren't aware about in boxing, whether it's your back to the ropes and the strands and the marks that you get there, the punches you take on the arms and the shoulders and all the bruising you get here and here and that kind of stuff before we've even got to the face. Like, how long is it before you're normal again after a fight of that intensity?
Listen, 12 rounds is a long time. It's a really long time for a boxing match. Boxing is so explosive. It is so, there's so much. You know, the metabolic demand of a round of boxing is crazy. I mean, the amount of calories you burn, you know, how difficult, how strong you have to be, how fast you have to be, how explosive every maneuver is. To do that for 12 rounds at the world-class level with another guy who's trying their best to take your head off is, I mean, I can't even put it to words. But every fight's different. And honestly, that one, surprisingly, is as grueling as it was, other than my eye and my nose, I was okay. I really didn't, you know, he didn't land a lot of punches. There wasn't like a lot of infighting. I used my legs a lot. I was in fantastic shape. So, you know, I had my soreness from, you know, being active and being mobile. But in terms of how my body recovered after that fight, as opposed to other fights where, you know, maybe I thought were actually kind of physically rougher or more demanding, really wasn't that bad. I made jokes on Twitter. I covered my eye. I'm like, I'm actually fine, because I didn't have a mark anywhere else except for my horrible eye. My eye was as black as a shirt, but, you know, the rest of me was pretty fine.
So your next fight was your first one, not in New York.
Yeah.
And it was over in Macau, which I went to Manny Pacquiao's fight with Brandon Rios before you went out there. I didn't go to your fight out there, but I mean, how good was Manny Pacquiao?
The best I ever fought by a long shot. The thing about him, and this is something that I don't think anyone would ever be able to surmise about fighting him if you haven't been in a ring with him. His ability to change his rhythm and to adjust was the most difficult part. You know, aside from how awkward he is, he literally does everything wrong as a boxer. His fundamentals doesn't fight fundamentally at all. Hands are down, weird stances on one foot, generates power still, super, super fast, tough as nails. Like, you got all those things. But everybody knew that. We all knew that. Coming into it, I knew it was going to be like that. I knew it was going to be very, very difficult to figure him out from all that. But what I didn't realize was that his ability to understand your rhythm, acknowledge it, adjust it on the fly was second to none. It was just, every time I felt like I finally got him, I was like, "Ooh, I got you." I felt like a light bulb went off in his head, and he almost showed me, and then he made an adjustment. And I was like, "Ugh!" And then I'm chasing him again to try and get back to that rhythm, and then he cracks me with a shot. And then I'm like, "All right, now I'm thinking about that." So he was just so good at setting the tone and keeping him, you know, keeping one step ahead of you.
What was the vaunted Pacquiao power like?
The thing about Pacquiao is he's very fast, right? So, yeah. You know, speed is power. Shots that you don't see hurt you more than others, because that's another thing. He throws punches from wild angles. So you don't see the punches. So that's going to make them harder. He's very, very fast. So that's going to make them harder. But also, he had very heavy hands for a small guy. And that's another thing. He's not that small. Standing next to him on the scale, I was like, everybody said this guy was really small. He's not small. But yeah, no, he'd very, very heavy hand. Like, his hands are just hard. Some guys just have like bricks for hands. I think Keith Thurman said the same thing about Manny. He's got bricks for hands. He really does. So he's got the speed, he's got the heavy hands, and he's got the punches that he hits you that you don't see. But in terms of just physicality, physical strength, and power punching, I thought Ruslan hit harder. Ruslan was just so strong.
So obviously, coming off the back of the Provodnikov fight, did you go into the Pacquiao fight thinking you were going to win?
Yes.
And was that based on you, and also perhaps the fact that Pacquiao had lost to Marquez and he'd had the close fight with Bradley, and you thought maybe it's just your time, you're getting him at the right time for you and for him?
100%. Like, I knew it was early for me. You know, it was only my 21st pro fight. And, you know, coming off the Ruslan fight, it was a big step up, which was a big step up from the fight before that. You know, I got rushed very much. You know, I got rushed very much for the, you know, from, you know, getting ranked in the, you know, in the top five with the Taylor fight, to right to a world title, to then right to Manny Pacquiao in a new weight class. So in hindsight, it wasn't the best situation for me, but you know, like, there was no telling me any different. But I was riding high, man. I was an undefeated world champion. I was a 20-0 undefeated world champion. I was very, very confident in my skills. You know, the eye was an issue in training throughout the entire camp, but I just didn't even let that into my brain. You know, I was there to win. I thought we had a good game plan. I like you said, the timing seemed right in terms of Pacquiao's age and in terms of what he was coming off of, in terms of what we were coming off of. But you know, I was wrong. The guy still had the goods for a number of years after that.
Hey, but obviously, going into a fight with Manny Pacquiao, it's boxing's lottery ticket, right? I mean, it was either him or Floyd, right? That you know you're going to get the big money. So, did you have it in mind, not just obviously that you were going to win, but did you spend that money in your mind? And did you think, I know what I'm going to buy, I've always wanted this? Because it gives you that kind of financial freedom, right? When you have when you earn that kind of money, because that's, like I said, you know, you then move into a different caliber of, you know, the probably the top 5% of the sports earners, right? When you're in those kind of mega fights.
Yeah, you know, and I had a bunch of those where I made, you know, never like Pacquiao. Pacquiao was obviously the highest payday, but I you know I fought a couple really big fights, you know, after that, and made some decent coin. But no, man, I live pretty low. I'm not a big spender at all. My first paycheck, you know, in the Provodnikov fight, I paid off my school loans. You know, I had about 50 grand worth of school,
Wow.
College debt, and I pressed that button, got rid of all that money right away. So I was zeroed out in debt. I had no money, but I was zeroed out at that point. But I knew I had the Pacquiao fight coming, so I was like, all right, I'm gonna, you know, I'm gonna make more money than I've ever seen before. You know, for this one, I was terrified of when that money hit my bank account, and I saw it there. I was like, ugh. Most people were really excited. I wasn't like that. I was worried. I was like, what stupid thing am I going to buy with this?
It makes sense, though. It makes sense. If you haven't had it and then you're there, you're like, I do protect that at all costs because I know what it's like to not have it and it's not fun. So let's try and keep that there because life's going to be a lot better if it's just sitting there, right?
Yeah. And I also, you know, I just said, I'm like, I'm still going to make more money. So I don't need to spend this now. I've always thought like, all right, I'm still going to make more money. I can worry about then. I know what I need for the, you know, for the year. Everything else goes into wherever it's going, and that's going to be protected. And then if anything, you know, if anything changes, then you know, I'll figure out what to do then. But this will be a lot more fun to spend later than now.
Have you got any stories out of Macau, the experience being out there?
Yeah, Macau. So we went out there like 2 months prior to the fight for the press tour. So our press tour was crazy. We went to six cities, I think. We did New York City, we did Las Vegas, we did San Francisco, we did LA, we did Shanghai, and then we did Macau. So seven cities. We did a seven city press tour, flying on private jets all over the place, coming into grand arrivals with, you know, thousands and thousands of people, autograph signings, on lines for an hour, just signing autographs, taking photos. And that was in like almost every city. And that was wild. Macau's a wild place. After I was actually hanging out with my buddy Luke Rockhold. Him and I were like bouncing around Macau one of the nights we were on the press tour, and just you know, running amok around town.
It's
No,
like a
that.
mini Vegas, right? With like three or four
Yeah.
casinos, and that's kind of it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And at the time, I was actually training in the Venetian in Las Vegas,
Okay.
and the Venetian in Macau is basically a carbon copy, just twice the size. It's massive. So it was kind of weird for me to be like, you know, I did the press corps, I got to see what the Venetian was like, and then I'm living there for 2 months, you know, while I'm training, and then I go there to live there for the week before the fight and the fight, and it was bizarre, a bizarre feeling. It was kind of strange, surreal, the way that worked out. But yeah, good, a lot of good memories, a lot of fun. Something that you know, I don't think too much about. But yeah, now that I'm even thinking about it right now, I'm thinking, oof, that was a wild time.
Hey, so with that Pacquiao money in the bank, I know you said, oh, I'm gonna earn more. Was there any thought of thinking, oh, you know, I've won, I'm out, let's get out? Or that wasn't
No.
even an option? No.
No. I was so upset with the loss. I was so dejected about you know, the performance and everything that went up to it. I wanted to get back right away. And I just, you know, it took a long time for me to kind of realize how good I was. You know, I was told always that this is not going to work because you're a karate guy, you're a kickboxer. So, you know, I've yeah, and I was like, oh, I'm here now, you know, and I'm here to stay. I want these big fights. I want to keep fighting. I love this.
And that prompted you to move to John David Jackson, right?
Yeah. So we were talking about stepping up trainers, and I had gone to other trainers in the past. I you know, I trained Robert Garcia for a couple camps, but always just came back to my guys in New York, and Las Vegas. But then it was time to make a change. You know, that decision, I bounced around. I went to a couple. We had a couple ideas, different coaches that we were going to work with, and then I met John, and him and I hit it off. You know, I like John a lot. He's a great guy. He's been there, and even though he was a Southpaw, stylistically, he was you know, he was a rhythm fighter. He was a combination puncher. You know, it kind of made sense. He wasn't like a big knockout guy. So for him and I to work together, it kind of made sense. And he was down in South Florida, and I'd been doing my training camps down there anyway. So that it was, it made sense for the time.
I love the fact that you've got a lot going for you locally, but you've gone and learned your craft on the road at all these different training camps, sparring all these guys. Like, kudos for you for doing that and moving out the bubble to further your education and stuff. Like, it's probably as much as anything else the making of you, right? Going around these gyms and maybe getting your butt kicked in a few of them.
If I didn't do that, I wouldn't be here. And not only skill wise, but also acknowledging, you know, my talent. I remember sparring Canelo and being like, and then, you know, I'm looking at him in Ring Magazine with a Ferrari, and I'm like, I'm this good, you know, I can do this, you know, because you just needed that. One of my sparring partners back in New York who's a friend of mine now. He's long since retired. He was a pretty good pro, Mike Lefty Brooks. He recalls when I came home from Vegas and started whooping his butt. He was like, man, he's like, I used to get the better of you. Then you went to Vegas, came back. He was like, man, I don't think I ever beat you around ever again. He's like, you came back a whole different thing. And he said, he was like, it wasn't anything else but this. You just realized that you had it. You could do it. And I was like, yeah, that's what it was.
So you're basically telling me that you kicked Canelo's ass and thought, hey, maybe I need to stick around.
I'll send you the video. I got a couple of rounds. Okay. I did not kick his ass though.
I love it.
For the record.
I had a meme going there for a little bit, or something was going to go viral. So you boxed Amir 6 months later. That obviously doesn't give you the longest time in the world with John. You were known for speed, but Khan and Pacquiao are probably two all-time greats for speed, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A whole different level. Whole different level. Khan was actually faster than Manny. And I've said that time and time again. Is Manny has a really good first step, right? Like that first step is so quick. So he's got that quickness. But his combination punching, although it's very good and fluid, it's not like Khan's. Khan, it's almost like he's like an octopus. He's hitting you with like two punches at once. It's wild. His combination punching is so fast. The difference, though, I could time Khan. I could tell when he was going to go. Manny was way harder to figure out. Khan is Amir had, and he had tells, and I was ready for those, which is why I was able to crack him with so many right hands in that fight.
Yeah, so you're talking about Manny's unpredictability, right? Which even when you just watched him on the pads with Freddie, and you see him spring in and spring out and stuff, you know, like, it makes you wonder if even he knew what he was going to do. But he just, you know, just incredible.
Honestly, it didn't seem like it. He's just a whirling dervish. He just went out there and just let those things go, and they're flying. And like I said, they're hard and they're fast. And you know, he was always like bladed off in a certain way that he was also protected. Even though he never looked like it, people always say, oh, he's got no defense. I'm like, he's not that easy to hit. Trust me. But yeah, no, having those fights back to back, that was a very hard route for me. It would have been, you know, I didn't complain at all because I wanted the fight. The fight came up.
Yeah.
And I said, I've always wanted to fight Amir Khan, and I've always been an opportunity guy, right? If an opportunity arises, I know that the door's not always open. And I knew for me specifically in the sport of boxing, I was not going to get second chances. So every opportunity that ever came my way, I took, which is why I've had so many big fights against top guys. I didn't sit back on any of those options when they arose. So when they brought up Amir Khan as a possible fight, I jumped at it. I'm like, yeah, you know. And did I need a tune-up fight? Absolutely. But it didn't matter. I wanted the fight.
But, and you are also a poster boy for staying in shape, right? And so if you're always in shape, you're never going to be too far away, you know, from a big fight, because the phone could go at any time.
Yeah. And that was an abbreviated camp, the Amir Khan fight that came up pretty quick. You know, a lot of my big fights did, honestly. Amir Khan did, Spence did, even Conor Benn. That fight came together very, very, very last minute.
So in terms of Khan, how highly do you rate him?
Very high. Very high. I think he is one of the best guys that we've seen in our generation. He gets a bad rap for, I think, a lot of it more is out of the ring stuff than is in the ring accomplishments. Because if you look at what he did at 140, and even his run at 47, I mean, he was top notch. And then he made that move to fight Canelo at 54, which was, I mean, listen, I my hat. You got you know, you got cojones to do that, but that's, and I'm sure you made quite a penny, but man, that was a bridge too far, if you ask me.
Yeah, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. So you came back with a tough win over Eric Boone, and then you fought Spence. It was a pretty cool stat here that I thought, that it said you made 100,000 more than Errol, but online it said that you are unhappy with your purse. Is that right? Is that something that stood out to you?
I was unhappy with how much money my promoter got.
Okay.
Which was part of the whole purse there. That was a point of contention for all of my big fights, those last couple of fights, because I believe I was being taken advantage of, and if you ask anybody, they would say the same thing for a lot of those fights. And there was a lot more money in the pot than I was being told there was, and I was deserving of a lot more of that money than I was getting. And that was the one that was really the straw that broke the camel's back, because that's when we had to get legal and get it taken care of.
And is that why you took 18 months out?
Yep. I didn't want to be out. I didn't want to be out at all. But I couldn't do anything until all that legal stuff got taken care of.
But you had a side gig. You were doing nutrition for fighters, right?
I wasn't doing that during, but I had time off, and it came up pretty quickly, you know, while I was out of the ring. It was like within 6 months, I had offers for those kinds of jobs. And, I did back-to-back camps with Danny Jacobs, Sullivan Barrera, and then Danny again. I think we did five camps with Danny.
So I definitely wanted to speak to you about this. Obviously you have a book, Fighter's Kitchen. What was behind that? Was that you thinking, I've got this knowledge and I want to put it out there, or you actually wanted to share it with boxers, you know, and you think they need it?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's not just for boxers. I just love to cook, and I actually started the writing that book in the Manny Pacquiao camp. You know, social media was kind of on the rise at that point. I mean, it's been around for a long time, but it was something that I was really pushing during the Manny Pacquiao camp, and I was posting a lot of my food, which is how Danny actually reached out and was like, hey man, can you like come to camp? Like, this food looks great. So then I was putting that book together for a long time, and then a publisher reached out to me and they said, hey, we got this idea for a book called The Fighter's Kitchen. We want you to author it. What do you think? And I was like, man, I'm halfway done with this book already. Let's go.
Wow.
So that's how that kind of came together. And it worked out because, you know, I have so many fighters reach out to me to help them in their camps. And, you know, a lot of these guys, they want me to be in camp. I'm like, well, first of all, there's only one of me. And second of all, that's going to cost a lot of money. You know, if you're going to have me for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks, you know, that's going to cost a lot of money. Yeah, sure. So I know, listen, I'd like to help everybody, but there's only one of me, and for me to, you know, to be able to do that job, it's gotta be worth my time. So the book is helpful in that sense, that it's like, you can't have me, but you can have the recipes, and it's very easy to follow. And you know, a lot of people have nutritionists now anyway, or cooks, and they can just use those recipes.
So, I mean, this is a kind of broad strokes question, but how old fashioned is boxing's knowledge on nutrition? It seems to me it's terrifying, particularly, you know, you see these weight cuts that are extraordinary and people saying, oh, you know, I've not had a drink in 2 days, a drink of water in 2 days. And, you know, I've eaten a grape in 3 days and stuff. It seems crazy. We touched upon it earlier with this bodybuilding, right? The guys starving themselves to be in this great condition to look good. But obviously boxers are starving themselves when they need to be able to perform and be at their best.
Yeah, it's very antiquated. It's gotten better. It's gotten a lot better in the last 10, 15 years, but it's still pretty bad. I think MMA did a really good job with that, because they got a lot of guys who were like college wrestlers and high level wrestlers. So they, you know, their understanding of weight cuts and having like team nutritionists, you know, you guys go to the Olympic Training Center and like, you're going to be speaking to nutritionists. They're going to be looking over your food. You've got, you know, you've got options. And listen, I don't care how much you're not into it. You're going to learn something over the decade that you're a high level guy being surrounded by, you know, organized training systems. Boxing misses that. There is no organized training system. You know, you wrestle in school, you know, there's a team and there's coaches that are vetted and hired. Boxing's not like that. You guys throw a towel over their shoulder and grab a bucket and they're a coach. So it's definitely left us kind of in the dark, you know, the dark ages when it comes to nutrition and high level training, but it's definitely getting better. You still see a lot of that though. I see it every day in the gym. These guys are they really just don't know what's going on. And some of these, and hey, listen, some of these nutritionists who are out there, some of the people that are being hired, they're not very helpful either. They're not doing much better than the fighters are.
So, it's kind of, you know, I think the fighters have, and I don't know if Ricky Hatton's to blame with this when we look at feast and famine and going up in between weight and ballooning between camps. He certainly didn't help, but Chris Eubank has put up these videos, I don't know if you've seen recently, of him ahead of this fight with Conor Benn. And he was walking around with a KFC bucket. And the other thing is he's been walking around, he was seen having a bit of chocolate cake on his birthday. And I'm like, that's probably healthy, right? Because, I mean, not saying eat that all the time, but like we still get this thing where fighters are saying, oh, I'm missing out on my Christmas dinner, you know, being in training camp and stuff. I'm like, well, you know, if you've got a good balance, you can have, like, I'm not saying even 80-20 in camp, but if you've got 90-10, you can live, right? Like, you can have the treats. And, you know, obviously it's about calories as well. You're burning 3,500-4,000 calories a day, then maybe you can take in 3,000-4,000 calories a day too, right?
Absolutely. And I think that's a major point of contention that people don't realize. You know, a lot of fighters are all or nothing. So, you know, when they're off, and they put on tons of weight and they eat whatever they want. And when they're in camp, they're just starving themselves. That's an excellent point. I'm glad you brought that up. Absolutely. I mean, the way that we train, the calorie burn, the metabolic needs that we go through camp, you can eat very well and enjoy the food that you eat. I always did. That's one of the reasons why I think people really took note of my nutrition and my food, because I post a lot of it on my social media, and I think people were amazed that I was eating hamburgers once a week, you know, and I was still ripped and lean and making weight easily. But I mean, it's all about, you know, variety and moderation have always been my key terms when it came to any kind of nutrition, whether you're a regular person or a professional athlete. But just, you know, you gotta, like you said, it's calories in, calories out in terms of our output. You've gotta put that back in, and how you put that back in and with what matters. But if you're eating the right amounts, I mean, you can have cheesecake every day. You can literally fit it in a way, you know, macros wise, calories wise, and it'll work, and you'll still get ripped. You'll still get lean, and you'll still have energy. So I was thinking about this before. When you're talking about how antiquated, you know, these ideas are, you know, I had a lot of people during like the keto, you know, craze that was, which is kind of, I guess, still coming on, but it was more so a couple of years ago, especially with Dillashaw before he got in trouble for the PEDs. He was really pushing this ketogenic diet. I had so many fighters reaching out to me, boxers, and being like, hey man, why wouldn't you just do keto? Well, you need carbs, you know. But you'll make weight so easy. I'm like, yeah, but you got to fight.
You got to train as well. You got to fuel the training too, right?
Exactly. So like, you know, boxing and fighting, everything we do is explosive. You know, your body's preferred source of energy during that is going to be your carbohydrates. It's going to be your glycogen stores. If you're just eating, you know, fat and some protein, it's going to be really difficult to dig down and have that engine to be explosive. But yeah, I had so many guys, yeah, but you'll make weight easy. I'm like, yeah, but you got to train and you got to fight. This isn't a contest to make weight. It's a fight. You got to feel good to fight. But yeah, like those kind of things would come to me from very professional people. And I'm like, you do not know how this works. You don't know how the human body works. You don't know how the fighting works. This is scary.
Yes. I mean, I did have this conversation in a bite-sized chunk, pardon the pun, with Shane McGuigan recently. And I mean, you know, hey, obviously there are, I think, such things as good calories and bad calories. But I also think that, you know, like you said, you know, you can take your foot off the gas and then get it back another time. You know, like, you know, if you have a bit of cheesecake today and that makes up 400 of your calories, then clean it out tomorrow, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or the rest of that day and whatnot. I mean, the calorie burns, depending on what kind of person you are in terms of training, you know, when you have those hard sessions, you know, those kinds of, like you said, it's probably a good thing he's having that chocolate cake. You know, some of those well-placed dirty items are actually really good in terms of your recovery, your glycogen stores, you know, your calories, your sodium. You know, you're going to need that back after, you know, if you have a really hard metabolic conditioning session and where you're really zapped, listen, having a bagel or having, you know, a burger or having, you know, something like that, that's, you know, considered dirty, is actually a good thing. Your body's going to soak that right up. And it's going to not only make you feel better physically in terms of glycogen stores and get your sodium back and rehydration, but also mentally. It's like having that, like that kind of psychological edge where it's like, okay, I can be a normal person a little bit, even though I'm training to be a gladiator.
Or as a reward, right? You know, I busted my ass today, I'm going to have that.
I have a really funny quick story. When I was training for my first world title in kickboxing, I was 21 years old, and I am an overtrainer. I've always been that kind of guy. I pushed my limit way beyond, you know, and I always thought that was the way to get ahead. And I had mentioned my injuries earlier, and that's a big part of it. Overtraining is real, and it's very real when it comes to fight sports and it comes to training for fights. So I was definitely overtrained. Looking back on it now that I know physiologically what overtraining looks like, I was so overtrained. I mean, I was just completely shot, and I was young and just working really hard and, you know, recovering well because I was young. But I had a breakdown one night, and it was after one of my sparring sessions. It was terrible, and I was really close to the fight, and I was really worried about making the weight. And I went to Taco Bell, which is like a fast food place over here, and I ordered like the entire menu. And I sat in the corner of the restaurant, like hood up, and just devoured tons of tacos and food and all this like sodium and fat and everything, just ate it all. And I was just like, and I wasn't done. I went home and I ate ice cream. Like really went over off the deep end. And I used to be super, super strict when I was young. And I remember I felt really bad about it. I went for a nice long run, but then I just completely felt better. Finished out the last, you know, 6 or 7 days of camp, made weight, no problem. Felt awesome. Went on to, you know, win the title. But it was such a psychological relaxation for me to kind of let that go. It was needed. It was needed. Yeah. I didn't know I needed it, but I needed it. And my body told me I had to do it, and I did it.
That's great stuff. I mean, you just wouldn't hear that. You just, you know, you don't hear those kind of stories. One thing, on the nutrition thing before we kick it on just to the latter bit of your career. You think how do you reconcile this in terms of fighters being told, you know, you walk into a gym, you're 175 pounds, they'll be like, oh yeah, you should fight a welterweight because you're going to be massive at that. You know, because that happens, right? I've seen it happen. And, you know, at what point is that? I mean, I know everyone's built differently, and you know, physiologically, there's not a one size fits all answer for that. But there's still that mindset where someone walks in the gym and they'll be like, "Ah, you could get down to such and such," you know, without necessarily thinking about performance.
Lighter's not always better, for a number of reasons. One, guys are faster at lighter weight classes. So if you're a guy stylistically and physically, and your physical gifts, speed's not one of your things, being bigger is not really going to help you. If you're slow at 75, you're going to be, you know, maybe you'll be a little faster at 47, but those guys are going to be a lot faster. So there's that. Part of it's your style. Part of it's also just your physiology. Some guys in their training are just going to gain more muscle than others. They have the propensity to build muscle. So even if they get lean, they're still going to maintain a lot of lean body mass, and trying to lose that lean tissue is not a good thing either. So understanding what kind of athlete you have in front of you, I think, is really important for that. I always say, I mean, get as lean as you can while still being healthy and performing well. And then I would look to help get the help of a nutritionist, someone to check your current body fat, check your current hydration status, and then just do a little crunch of some numbers. You know, it's like, all right, well, how much body fat can you realistically lose and still be healthy? You know, you don't want to get too far under, you know, 5-6% body fat. You're getting really, really lean at that point, and that's really hard to maintain. It's probably not healthy to maintain for most people. But yeah, so say if you're like thinking about your 8% body fat, you get down to there, what are you going to weigh then? You just subtract what those pounds will be. You take out what, you know, some water out of the body to make that weight. Like, is it feasibly possible for you to even make that weight? Because that's another thing too. Guys try to make weight classes they literally can't make. They have too much tissue. And especially lean tissue. You don't want to lose too much. You're going to lose some, of course, you're hypocaloric. But yeah, that's where I think getting a professional to kind of look over your hard numbers objectively and see if it's even possible for you to make the weight is probably the first or second step before you even try and do that. But at the end of the day, it's all about performance. It's a fight, man. This is true a meritocracy, man. It's meritocracy. You got to fight. You got to win. I don't care what you weigh in the scale, like you said. I don't care what you look like. You can't fight. If you can't win, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Hey, so you returned after doing your bit of nutrition with Danny and Sullivan and the gang. I was going to say, did you miss it? But I kind of, you know, you're probably that pent up about having to deal with the stuff that you had to deal with legally that, you know, you were probably just, I don't know, just fuming with it all, really, I guess. You're just angry and upset about everything.
I went through all of it. I was miserable and I was depressed for a while. It was really hard being in some of those camps. I'm talking like real depression during some of those camps. I was working and doing my job because, you know, that's what I do. But I mean, my time alone was not fun, not happy. I was in a very dark place through a lot of that. I not only did I miss it, but I knew I was losing money and I knew I was losing opportunity and I knew I was losing momentum. So I had no momentum, but yeah, no, I was a tough time.
Yeah. Cause it's a short career and I guess you're just seeing the hourglass ticking through, right? The sands. Yeah. So anyway, you had three fights culminating in this bout with Tommy Coyle, who's been a guest on this podcast before. Tommy's a bit of a cult hero over here, obviously. What did you make of Tommy and the effort he put forth against you in Madison Square Garden?
Tommy's a stud, man. He is a tough dude. What a guy too. You know, everyone told me before the fight, before we're gonna fight, he's a great guy, you're gonna love him. Like, I don't want to love him. I'm gonna fight him. Don't tell me how much of a great guy he is. I'm sure he is, but we're gonna fight. But yeah, no, that was an awesome event. You know, we fought on the undercard of Andy Ruiz and Anthony Joshua, which I always say, unfortunately, for a number of reasons, Andy Ruiz knocked out Joshua and stole the night. But I think Tommy and I had the fight of the night prior to that. You know, it was a hell of a scrap. It was a fun fight. I love watching that fight. We just, I mean, he kept saying, we got to have a war. We're going to have a war. We're going to have a war. So I was like, all right, shit, let's have a war then. you want a war in the garden? Let's have a war in the garden. And we did. You know, I didn't go out there and just try and box him. Like I made it a fight. We had a hell of a scrap and, he's a tough guy. He's strong. We've actually become quite friendly since the fight and talk somewhat regularly. He is a great guy. Just like everybody said that I would like him, I'd do it.
Hey, you're a clever dude. Why didn't you just box him?
I mean, he picked a fight with me. So it's, you want to fight? We'll fight.
I love it.
I'm clever sometimes, but I'm dumb also.
There was another break, nearly 2 years. What was going on there? Was that more legal shenanigans or was that you taking
that was COVID,
some time?
Man.
Oh, that okay.
Was COVID.
Right.
That was
wow.
COVID. So
you
so
got hit by that.
Bad. Yeah. It was a number of things, but it was mostly COVID. So the fight with Tommy was a title eliminator, right? Because I was defending my international WBO super lightweight championship that night.
Yep.
Obviously defended that. And then I got the number one position for the WBO, which would have been against Maurice Hooker.
Yes.
In the process of us setting up the fight between him and I, they made the unification bout with him and Ramirez. And in boxing, unifications always take precedent over everything else. So I got pushed to the side. They fight. I was hoping that Hooker was going to win the fight and then I would get the next fight. So I went to that fight to push that. I was on the air and everything. We all know Hooker gets knocked out. Ramirez breaks his hand in the fight, pushes everything back. And then he had his mandatory with Postol for the other belt that he had. And I was on the back burner. So I wasn't sure how that was going to happen. And then I was getting ready for a fight in early 2020. And then the pandemic hits. So part of it was angling to see what was going to happen between the ranking and the number one contention spot that I had. And then we kind of moved on because we knew we were going to have to wait for a bit. And then the pandemic hit. And I told my manager that, you know, they had all those shows going on during the pandemic. First of all, the fights were very low money. But, you know, just to stay busy, I would have done it. But also, a lot of those fights are falling out. Like,
yeah, opponents getting it and all the rest of it. Yep.
I told my manager, I'm not going to camp and going through a camp and then going and then someone on my team. Because at that time, it was like someone on your team goes positive, the whole fight's off. It was wild. There were so many fights going postponed. And I was like, we'll just wait. And at that time I was doing a lot of commentating. So that was keeping me busy, keeping me in the sport. And I maintained training throughout the whole time, stayed in great shape, and was just waiting for, you know, for the opportunity. And then once things started to settle down at the end of 2020, I was like, all right, I'm just going to camp. I went to camp and I trained all of 2021. I was like, whenever a fight's ready, I'm ready. And it sucks. Like we talked about, you know, me losing time on the clock, which is also probably why I'm still fighting. Cause I could have, if you take away those 2.5 years and those other, you know, that other 2 years, you know, I could have got a lot more done than I did. And maybe the bug would have left me sooner.
And then you fought your buddy, Mikhail Despierre, and then Conor Benn. Tell me about Benn, who's obviously big news over here in the UK.
Yeah, so the Benn fight came up after the, you know, I fought LePierre and I was like 142 and I was planning on fighting at 140. And the Benn fight came up, you know, they Hearn called us up and they were like, hey, but this fight, I'm like, I don't want to fight at 47. I want to fight, you know, I just fought a 40 2 months ago and, you know, or close to it. And we're going to keep moving that way. That's where I want to fight. And they just really kept pushing for it. And I was like, all right, bring your checkbook. If you really want to make this happen, I'm like, and then I was watching Benn then. I didn't watch a whole lot of him prior to them bringing him up to me. And then I was watching, I'm like, I saw things. I was like, oh, there are things I can capitalize on here. I can win this fight. And the camp went great. Again, it was a little bit short, but I had fought pretty close to that. So I wasn't too far off of shape. He's a talented young guy, definitely still a little raw, but he's getting better every time. Very explosive. He covers distance really well. I was really impressed with that for a shorter guy to cover distance in the ring, which is what I think is actually going to give Chris Eubank a lot of trouble.
So does the Chris Algieri from the Provodnikov fight beat the Chris Algieri that fought Conor Benn?
Hard to compare. I don't know. I think I was definitely more cautious, you know, back then. I felt with the Benn fight, I felt good. I felt like I hurt him a few times, especially I knew I hurt him to the body, but even some of the left hooks I landed to the head, I was like, ooh, I got a little too excited that I was like, oh, I can hurt this guy even at this weight, even though it's not my weight. And I was on the ropes and I should have got out of the way. I'm still pissed about that. I got caught. You know, I tried to counter when I should have tried to evade, where I think that, you know, that guy who fought Peronica probably would have evaded.
Hey, so you've had your fair share of fights, kickboxing, boxing, sparring, being on the road. Boring question, but also a hard one. Do you think about CTE and that kind of stuff and what might happen down the line?
Yeah, always have. Something that I've actually always thought about. And that's one of those things that it's a risky part of this sport, but it's a very realistic part of this sport. You know, everyone handles it differently in terms of what happens. There are guys like, you know, certain fighters that are still sharp as a tack and don't show any residuals. And then you've got guys who have very short careers who, you know, are punchy for the rest of their lives. So, you know, it's kind of a luck of a draw kind of thing, but you know, it's just something that you listen, everything in life is dangerous. You know, everything we do, every sport, everything. Ours is a lot more dangerous than other things, but yeah, it's just one of those things. Like, is it worth it? Is the risk worth it? You know, I think it has been so for me so far, but I guess we won't really know until the end of the timeline.
And there is a school of thought as well. You know, when I've spoken to people when I was writing Damage, which is about CTE and boxing, there was a school of thought that, you know, a healthy life, you know, particularly when we're talking with regards to nutrition, but also with sleep habits and different things like that will stand you in good stead. You know, even if you've got your share of trauma, as long as you're doing your bit, you know, nutritionally and sleep wise, then, you know, that stuff can possibly help down the line as well, right?
Also, absolutely. And also doing difficult tasks. There's a lot of good research that, you know, maintaining, doing things that are difficult, hand-eye coordination things can really be really helpful for your brain, keeping it young. You know, I've never smoked. I'm not a big drinker. I sleep. Like you said, sleep is really important. Nutrition has been a really big, I've stayed in shape my entire life. So all these things can also, you know, stem some of the flow of the negative stuff that can happen. But again, I mean, it's all luck of the draw. Get hit by a bus tomorrow.
Do you track your sleep?
Oh, yes. I got my Polar watch on. This thing tracks everything I do. I already got my 100% activity level for the day, even though I still have another workout to do. Pull up my sleep score real quick. I got my nightly recharge.
Okay. So I love it. 100%. Hey, look, listen, I used to really overtrain. He says, I've already got my 100%. I'm going to go train again.
Yeah. So it's only 1:30 here. Not even.
Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of, you know, you mentioned obviously those dark days, and one of my questions here was, what was the most challenging period of your life? Is that dark period you said when you were in camp and you saw the hourglass in the sand ticking through, or were there darker things than that you have been through? Because a lot of, you know, I mentioned brain trauma, but there's a lot of trauma in fighting, right? When you do this stuff and you're on the road and you're the sparring partner, or you're the B side, you know, where you're questioning yourself, and we've all got real life stuff, like we've all lost people and that kind of stuff too.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of them in this road. You know, it's easy for me to say that those gaps in my activity that were not my, you know, not my doing, were a dark time. And I definitely, like I said, dealing with depression and anxiety surrounding that was really, really tough. But I don't know if that was really that much more difficult than, you know, my times in my 20s leading up to getting my world title fight, where you know, I literally wanted to quit the sport because it wasn't panning out in the way that I had planned, and I thought I was wasting time then. You know, I was always chomping at the bit when I was young to get bigger fights, to get more recognition, to be out there, to get out of my hometown. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's it's all relative, but there's been a lot of dark times, and I think every champion will say that there's a lot of dark time, you know, on the way to the top.
Are you concerned about how much you might miss boxing, given that, like, you've got no intention of stopping? Or do you think you're just going to be too busy spinning all the plates that you've got going on elsewhere?
No, I'm definitely concerned about it, because of my competitive nature. I got to find something else to do. I might have to take up tennis or something, because I need something to push myself and to compete in too. I'm gonna need to compete, whether it be endurance sports like running or triathlons. I've done a few triathlons. I really enjoy that. But yeah, no, I don't think that competitive desire is ever really gonna leave me. And I hope it doesn't. I hope it doesn't. You know, it makes me who I am. I like being, you know, aggressive about trying to win and trying to get better. So,
One thing our mutual friend Dan told me as well, and I mean, this is something I saw him point out to you on the air the other day, but you've become over the years a real network whore, haven't you?
yeah.
You've been on everything, like Spike, HBO, Showtime, DAZN, ESPN, everything going, you've been on it.
Yeah, I mean, like, I remember earlier I said that I'm an opportunity guy. When the opportunities arose, I've never been one to pump the brakes. I'm like, yep, let's go, come on, get me on. You know, part of that is my confidence in myself, and knowing that, you know, put it on my shoulders, I'll make it work. You know, I can do it. So yeah, I didn't care where or who. Man, I'm a fighter. I'm a prize fighter. I want to fight. So, you know, that's always been my mentality. But I want people to see it because I'm good at it. And I think it's, you know, like, it should be out there. So for me, with those networks, you know, the opportunities arose, I was never locked in. I never used the excuse, well, I'm not with them, I can't do that. No, we can fight. We can make it happen. Prize fighters fight for money. This is what we do.
And now, obviously, I mentioned Dan there. I'd be remiss not to mention it. Now you're a podcaster. You're doing Inside Boxing with Dan Canobio, who is the son of my old friend Bob Canobio, who is the founder of CompuBox. And that probably is where you got your stats for the 1,100 punches that you threw in. God, what fight was that now?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And now you and Dan are tight, right?
I've known Dan for a long time. Dan's a Long Island guy. I've known Dan since, you know, my local days. And, but yeah, no, he reached out to me about this show like 6 months ago, and he's like, I'm thinking about you for this thing. He's like, would you be around for it? I'm like, yeah, hell yeah. Cause I've been on a show a number of times, and him and I have a very good rapport. So even our interviews always felt like podcasts anyway. We were just hanging out, talking about boxing. We both love this sport. You know, my knowledge goes really deep into this sport from all ages, and so does his. for us to do the show together makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Makes for good listening. And Chris, I'm really grateful for you making the time to do this within 3 to 5 working days of my original email, which is a joke me and you will get, but no one else will. But it's a shame. But no, I'm really grateful, man. I wish you nothing but good things with the rest of your boxing career and with the podcast with Dan and all the other stuff that you're doing with nutrition stuff, being a professor, and just everything that you're doing. It's great.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate you doing the research. I love when an interviewer goes into the annals of time to figure everything out. But no, this is excellent. Thanks.
Great stuff. Thanks, Chris. Take care.
Absolutely, man.
All right. Bye-bye.
So wonderful stuff from Chris. I wish we talked a little bit more about recovery. I wish we talked about when we talk about having sweet foods. I wish we talked about the downside of that. I think obviously we're talking about the upsides of that. We wish we talked about the downsides being inflammation, particularly for older fighters and older people like myself. If you have something sweet and try to train with some complex movements the next day, it's generally a lot harder to get going. But still loads to unpack there with Chris. I thought that the descriptions of the Provodnikov fight they stand up probably against any other description of fights that we've had in nearly 200 episodes. We are building towards episode 200, which is a watershed moment for this podcast. It's a huge, huge deal for me to hit 200. So hopefully I make it. Huge thanks to Chris for being such a wonderful guest, hugely articulate. And I haven't picked up Fighter's Kitchen, but I definitely will as a consequence of talking to Chris. And also a huge shout out to Dan Canobio for helping set up this interview with Chris. And you can check them out at Inside Boxing. Dan is from CompuBox, as we mentioned during the podcast. And I go back some ways with his dad, Bob, who's the founder of CompuBox and who you can listen to an interview with in the archives of Boxing Life Stories. As always, massive thanks to my sponsors at Hanson Lee Resourcing, Blaz and the Gang. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, they'll help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. I am just about through with working on Warrior, my book on Matthew Saad Mohammed, my late friend who passed away in 2014 and who signed a contract to write the book with me in 2001. So we are 21 years on. And hopefully the book via Pitch Publishing is out next month. It is available to pre-order already on Amazon and from Pitch and at all good booksellers. Guys, we are motoring towards 200. Give me a follow on Instagram and on Twitter at Tris Dixon, and we will be back next week.